there's no better feeling than a personal win. And the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Shouldn't you be at work?
It's a lovely chip! Oh, it's a brilliant goal from Lord Poheedon!
Still, it's not away. Southgate's shot. Milosevic scores.
DPR could do with a bit of magic from him, maybe.
This is it, it is! Andy Sinton from nothing!
Brian Roy has headed for it into the lead!
Whelan. Oh, what a goal from Noel Whelan!
No power on it whatsoever, but Taibbi has made a horrendous error.
Now, you know him better than anybody, probably. Do you back him to score quickly, yes or no?
Yes.
Oh, and it hasn't.
No.
Hello and welcome to Quickly Kevin with me, Josh Widdicombe. Joining me is Michael Marden and the man who isn't Chris Skull. It's Tom Crane. Hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, good. Due to a recording timings error, Chris Skull cannot be here this week for the emails, etc., the top and tail of the episode, as we call it, because, let's be honest, Michael, he misjudged how long it took to record an episode and needs to go into town. That's correct, isn't it?
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing over 100 episodes in, that can still happen.
He thinks you can record an hour and a half episode in an hour.
Yeah.
That's neither here nor there.
Also, I need to go into town feels like quite a sort of vague thing to do, doesn't it? I need to go.
Yeah, he said
town.
He had meetings in town.
Oh, once again.
Let's not forget that this is recorded the day West Ham play their first European game in probably 400 years. So he's probably meeting Darren Emerson to get the party started early doors. Thank you for stepping in, Tom.
Pleasure.
Shall we get straight on to the... There's no 90s o'clock news this week because there's no Chris Skull. There's no Roberto Baggio with shit because there's no Chris Skull. So that gives us extra time for the electronic postbag.
I'm Jim Rosenthal and this is the electronic postbag.
You've got mail.
Okay, big news. We have discussed last week... strikers that had bad goal scoring records in the 90s but were still considered good strikers. Andrew Carson comes in. The ultimate striker with the crap goal scoring record has to be Brian McClair.
Oh.
Brian McClair's goal scoring record is absolutely dog shit. Ready to defend him, Michael?
Of course, always ready.
Did you rate Brian McClair?
Loved him. Jocko McClair was a fantastic player. And also, I mean, I know what my defence is going to be because people seem to be attacking the same sort of player each time and judging them entirely
on
goals. Yeah,
ones that are no good in front of goal. Yeah. Brian McClair, let's just, for the record, he scored in 355 Manchester United appearances. He scored 88 goals.
Okay.
In 30 Scotland appearances. That's about one in four, isn't it?
One in four, yeah.
In 30 Scotland appearances. He scored twice.
I mean, I don't know enough about Scotland and their level during his peak playing time for the country.
Well, they would have been in the 1990 World Cup and Euro 92. So that's two successful qualification campaigns he's played in.
But he wasn't an out-and-out striker. Like,
yeah.
That's the thing. You sort of can't judge him just on goals. He was a forward, but he would also play deeper in midfield. He would sort of link up the play.
Would he be listed as a midfielder in Fantasy Football League at the moment?
I think he definitely would. If Mo Salah and Sadio Mane are midfielders, he would definitely be a midfielder. But he wasn't rubbish. Shall I run you through some of his honours?
His team honours in the teams that were carrying him.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if the teams were carrying him. I mean, that's unfair. The fact that he plays a part in these teams that win these honours, I think is a testament to his ability. But he's won Scottish Premier Division. He won four Premier Leagues, two FA Cups, a League Cup, five or six Charity Shields, European Cup Winners' Cup, European Super Cup. And he was there sort of pre-dominance as well. So he was kind of there in the early days. He's one of Fergie's very early signings. So he was a very, very good player and is a player that is loved and adored, I would say, by most Manchester United fans. So I think it's unfair to judge him just on that.
Okay. Do you know what? I was just going to take you through his goal scoring record for Man U. Interestingly, he did really well for them before they got good. In his first season in this Division 1 then, he scored 24 in 40.
Nice. That's a fantastic
record. That's great.
Yeah,
that's
really good. Exactly. Then, and he had a couple of lean seasons, a 5 in 37, etc.
Yeah.
And then he got 18 in 42, which is good. Then Man U's period of dominance, McClare went off the boil as a... I mean, maybe they just played him further and further back. Because in the 96-97 season, which we talk about today, he scored 0 in 19 games.
Well, that's obviously not a great record. What I would say then is... Once we signed Cantona, McClare, who used to play as a striker alongside Mark Hughes, he began dropping deeper into midfield. So a reflection of that is that his goal record is going to be slightly less prolific. But he was a fantastic player. He was player of the year for his first season. But I think a testament to how good a player McClare actually was is that he signed for United in 87-88 and was there for 10 years until 97-98. Now, the back end of that, he was far more of a kind of utility player, lot of sub appearance, but would slot in anywhere across the midfield and the front line. And he was one of the last, if not the last, of the old guard to leave the club. Now, with a manager like Ferguson, who is notoriously unsentimental when it comes to shifting players on, be it Brian Robson, Steve Bruce, Kanchelskis, Paul Ince, like, the moment he got a whiff that those guys, that their abilities were failing, they were gone. They left the club. And McClare was there until 97-98. One more year, he would have won the Champions League, which is incredible. So I think he was a very good player that should not be judged only on his goals.
Okay. Crane, any views?
Did you have those conversations when you were in secondary school? Let's say, for example, when he scored 5 in 37 with your mates, and you'd say, if I played up front for Man United, would I score more than 5 goals in 37 games, despite the fact you were 14 and you weren't even in the school team. You'd still be discussing whether, if you were up front instead of Andrea Salenzi for Forest, whether you'd actually get... I really had that belief at that age that I would, just by hanging around, get 6 or 7 goals a season, which is incredibly arrogant.
Yeah. Do you think Brian McClare is the proof that wouldn't have happened?
Yeah, I think there is. Yeah, these players are so much better than you can ever imagine. And I'm sure you're right, Michael. I'm sure that he offered so much more in his all-round game. There must be a reason that Ferguson loved him, surely. I did generally believe that. I used to think if I was popped up front for Man United, I'd definitely get 8 goals. That was what I was like when I was 15 or whatever.
Do you think you'd have got one?
Ridiculous. I don't think I'd score 1 goal. No, I think I'd be so exhausted after about 7 minutes that it would just be... Basically, if I don't score in the first 7 minutes, then it's not going to happen, and I'm not going to score in the first 7 minutes, so I don't think I'd score once.
Okay. Hi, guys. Big fan of the show. Inspired by the latest episode in which you discuss Kevin Keegan's involvement in the Meat Management Industry Awards. I wanted to share with you a story of when Ruud Gullit spoke at a work event of ours a few years back, which didn't go entirely to plan. At the time, I was working on the sponsorship team of a Champions League sponsor. Our annual internal company event was coming up, business updates, new launches, etc., etc., featuring all the big dogs from across the country. And having only recently joined, keen to make an impression, put myself forward to contract some talent for the event. Having worked with him in my previous job, I thought Champions League winner and all-round 90s football legend Ruud Gullit would be the perfect choice. The idea went down well, so I set about getting everything sorted, drafting a rough structure on the sort of topics I wanted him to cover when he came on stage, teamwork, achieving a common goal, and other such corporate nonsense. When the day arrived, however, after talking to him backstage, it transpired he had definitely not read the briefing, but assured me that he'd done tons of these before and would just freestyle it. Uneasy, but without much comeback, I simply reaffirmed the key topics he needed to cover, and on he went. It started well, and the audience seemed to be receptive to him, but then came his two anecdotes. The first, about a team-building day when he was at Chelsea. Okay, so far so good, I thought. Which involved them going to Epsom races, and Erling Johnson getting so drunk he, to quote, shit in his pants and fell over on the bus home.
I really hope that's like the 13B bus as well. I hope it's just like a normal bus.
Imagine getting so drunk that you shit yourself.
Yeah, that's awful.
Also, falling over on the bus home. is nothing compared. Is such a non-thing compared to shitting in your own pants.
Oh, that's awful.
However, the second anecdote was about the biggest penis he'd ever seen,
right,
which belonged to AC Milan manager Arrigo Sacchi.
Wow. That was a twist. I wasn't expecting that.
And how did he see the manager's penis? That feels like they're not sharing one. The shower. He's not in the bath after the game. Unless Sacchi's so proud of it that when the other players are going to the showers, he's taking his suit off and going, "I'll come in as well, lads." Check out this.
It's the way he earns their respect.
That's incredible. Okay. Wow.
Inconceivably, my boss and his boss saw the funny side and we were able to move on. So though Keegan may have been a seemingly strange choice to the Meat Management Industry Awards, I'd imagine his chat would be far less blue than Ruud Gullit's.
Yeah.
I'd love to see that speech. I'd be so excited. Yeah. On Kevin Keegan, someone has found, I'm not going to go into what bracket he is. I think that's crass to say what he's earning, but they found on a website a list of celebrities that you can hire for Kevin Keegan's rate. So this is who you could get for the same rate as Kevin Keegan. I think, if anything, Kevin Keegan is the best. His rate is too low. His rate is too low. Gillian McKeith.
Okay, well, Erland Johnson could have done with Gillian McKeith. Would have been a good booking. You're not well, Erland. You need to eat more roughage.
Annika Rice, John Hartson, Jeffrey Archer, Martin Kemp. That's a good booking.
Yeah.
Pete Waterman, Duncan Goodhue, Bill Oddie, Judy Murray, Midge Ure, Chris Akabusi, and Toya Wilcox, and Brian Blessed. Do you think Keegan's put himself in the wrong group?
You know how certain strikers would rather play a level down and score a lot of goals? Maybe Keegan's of the corporate mentality that if he lowers his level a bit, he'll get more corporate gigs.
There's a comedian I know who does that. There's a comedian who does corporates famously below their rate. Do you think Keegan's doing that?
Possibly.
Unless, I mean, it could be that Ruud Gullit is hoovering up all the top level corporate work at the moment because they know he's got such incredible stories from his time at Chelsea. So Kevin Keegan can't get in a look in.
Keegan sat there thinking, I wish I'd seen Bill Shankly's penis. Because I just lie and say he had a massive dick. Would you like to know what Keegan does? This is from Ross Hillett. I hired Kevin Keegan. I worked at a business-to-business conferences for 15 years. Approximately 10 years ago, my company ran the annual insurance conference in London. And we were looking for a relatively famous person that people across the UK and Europe of various ages would know and therefore would like to see at a post-event drinks reception. Given his days at Hamburg, German audience, Liverpool, older UK audience, and Newcastle with the infinite rant, younger crowd, I pushed for him over an ex-politician and a rugby star. The board thankfully agreed, and we hired Kev for the night. He was an absolute star.
Aww.
He turned up an hour early and went round every sponsor one by one, saying hello and taking pictures with everyone.
Oh, no way.
Then upon entering the room, the chairperson for the event got everyone to stand up and take part in a pre-planned Kevin Keegan quiz for everyone in the room, whereby if you got a question wrong, you sat down. So the person remaining standing would win an iPod.
And Kevin Keegan won an iPod.
No. He got the second question wrong about his career, number of England caps.
Oh, he was involved in it.
And he got the second question wrong.
How? Come on, Kevin. You should be one iPod richer.
Yeah. He got on stage and did 15 minutes of enjoyable anecdotes, oddly not mentioning St. Etienne, including how he was somewhat aggrieved that he'd become more famous for I Would Love It than his actual football achievements. Overall, a good egg and stayed for 2 hours more than he was contractually had to. In a good way, we weren't asking for him to leave. Hashtag sign him up, Ross Hillett.
That is so nice. That's great. Well, it's nice to hear,
isn't it, that? I've got a lot of respect for Kevin Keegan over this. I'm delighted.
Talking about Roberto Baggio, in particular, Scholes' absence for this section, I'd like to stealth in while he's gone, and I'd like to...
See if he listens to the show.
See if he listens to the show, but also I'd like to run my own feature this week.
Oh, called, okay.
Roberto Baggio was great.
But still, Baggio. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. What a goal by Baggio!
Little defence. This is me now going on the attack. It's my witness, if you like, in the courtroom of Baggio.
Yeah.
And I'd like to focus on his goal-scoring return, but at international level, arguably the highest level that any footballer can play. Now, as a point of cross-reference, I'd like to submit Alan Shearer as evidence.
Oh,
I think we can all agree that Shearer is, alongside Gary Lineker, perhaps the greatest England striker of
all. 12 games without a goal once, didn't he? But apart from that, yes, I think.
He did. His, for England, his record was 30 goals in 63 games.
Very strong.
Which is
very strong.
Yeah. It's a goal every 2.1 games.
Perfect, perfect.
And he is, you know, an archetypal centre forward, physical, strong. He's a goal scorer, scores every kind of goal. Mm-hmm. Roberto Baggio, not the same player as Alan Shearer, and someone who is criticised on this show by Chris for his goal-scoring record. At international level, in 56 games, scored 27 goals. So his average goals per game was 2.07, within 0.3 of Alan Shearer, someone who is universally recognised as having a very prolific good record. And in addition to that, Roberto Baggio scored 9 goals at different World Cups.
That's impressive.
Which is very impressive. Here's a list of players that haven't scored that many goals at World Cups. Eusebio, Diego Maradona, Rudy Völler, Thierry Henry, Lionel Messi, and Cristiano Ronaldo all have fewer goals at the highest level than Roberto Baggio. So I think
it's a little bit worried you're going to read out all players who haven't scored 9 goals at World Cups there. It's an incredibly long list. Because I do need to get on with my day, to be honest, Michael.
Diego Forlan, Asamoah Gyan. I could go on.
That's fascinating. I'm a huge Roberto Baggio fan. He's one of my best ever.
As is everyone in the world, Crane, except Chris Skull. Chris Skull, we watched a film about Baggio and he said he just didn't realise that he was a big deal.
Amazing.
Absolutely madness. Now, on another one of our favourite people to talk about. Hello, Quickly Kevin Teen. This is from Jonathan Hargreaves. If you have time for any more Peter Shilton penalty stories, I have a pretty good one. In 1998, I was at university at LSE. The student union wasn't the best, but every now and then, we would have a can't-miss event. I saw Judge Jules DJing one night. One event that was hands down, or feet first, or hands first, feet first, which is how Peter Shilton likes to dive, according to his tips. One event that was hands down, or hands first, feet first, the best, take a penalty against Peter Shilton. The setup of the student union was a bar on the ground floor, and in the basement was a bigger entertainment space where they'd set up the special events. On this evening, they had a five-a-side goal set up, and you could line up to take a penalty against Shilts himself. The place was packed. There was no cost to take a penalty, just a long line to wait in. If you scored, you won a bottle of Beck's. They had on the table, on the side, a dozen or so bottles to hand. It was quickly apparent that a dozen or so wasn't going to be enough.
Oh, brilliant.
I can't remember how many I saw scored, but I remember that of 6 mates I was with, 3 of us scored. Against Peter Shilton in a five-a-side goal. That is pathetic from Shilton.
When I was at school, I won't give the name, my friend, his parents used to enter these. They were called compers, which are people who enter competitions as a sort of as a hobby, basically, or more than a hobby. Anyway, they entered this Kellogg's competition around the time of Euro 96. We had to write a poem about Euro 96 and it would get put on the back of the box. Anyway, they won this. The prize was, it meant him and 4 other people had to take a penalty at halftime at QPR against Peter Shilton. And the winner would win a cash prize. My friend won that penalty shootout when he was 15, and he won £120,000.
What?
Jesus.
Yep.
No.
And he was 15. Yeah, yeah. And he suddenly became the coolest person in school. Mad. Absolutely mad. One of the people he was playing against was like an 11-year-old kid. Now, if I knew £120,000 on the line, I'd swap him out for someone else in the family, surely.
Surely.
I know he really wants to take
this
penalty.
The pressure on him. Like, you don't want that on a kid's shoulders.
What are you doing? To be honest, I'd probably pay like an ex-semi-pro to do it for me. I'd say, look, have a grand if you win this. Just pretend you're in the family.
Yeah, get in a ringer.
Do this.
I'd split 60 grand, 60 grand with Matt Letizia.
So what parents are going, you know, little Timmy, but he really wants to do this. He's always wanted to kick a ball at halftime at QPR. I mean, yeah, madness. But anyway, my friend won that.
Wow. Another penalty conceded by Peter Shilton. If you have any stories about Peter Shilton, Kevin Keegan, or strikers that don't, if you've got any strikers that are proper strikers with bad goal scoring records, this is the place to get in touch.
Get in touch with the show. Email hello@quicklykevin.com. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter @quicklykevin. And sign up to the mailing list at quicklykevin.com.
Now, before we get into the main body of the episode, I should say, if you want 15 minutes more of this and you want it on Fridays rather than Mondays, do sign up to the Patreon, patreon.com/quicklykevin. On there, we've got all the Steve Bruce episodes. We've got all the other extra episodes all there the moment you sign up. Lots of extra content. patreon.com/quicklykevin. Crane, also, who, you know, it's probably the most appearances of any Quickly Kevin guest. You now have your own podcast, which everyone should listen to because it's great.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, yeah, I'd love people to listen to it. It's called My Favourite Takeaway. And it's myself and my mate Simran. We go to a special guest house each week and we share their favourite takeaway with them. And we talk about food and food memories and takeaway disasters and all this sort of stuff. It's basically a show for people who love food but sort of can't always be bothered to cook it. It's the way we talk about it. We've been to your house, Josh.
Yeah.
We had an Indian takeaway with you, which was great fun. We got people like James Acaster and Andy Oliver and Ed Gamble and Tom Allen and all these brilliant people coming up. And it's just a lot of fun. It's really, really fun.
It's a great podcast.
Oh, thank you very much. Did you enjoy it?
I enjoyed doing it and I enjoy listening to it, which is more important because you're not trying to get people to do it. You're trying to get people to listen to it. So whether I enjoyed doing it is neither here nor there, Tom.
It's by the by. You've created a bit of a storm with the fact that you don't have rice with your Indian takeaway. And
which I stand by.
A radio show with Gabby Roslin 3 days ago, and they were discussing it on it.
Were they?
You don't have rice with it. They were. It was random. Yeah, yeah. They were talking about that. Then a guy talked about the podcast. It was very kind. But they were talking about the fact that you don't have rice with your Indian takeaway. So it's that sort of stuff. It's real sort of detailed moonshine.
My favourite takeaway, listen to it in the gaps when you're not listening to Quickly Kevin. And if you want to read any books, Chris wanted us to promote his book. He's got a book out on 90s football, which is called Can We Not Knock It? Go to his social media. It'll be in his biog, I'm sure. And if you like 90s literature, watching Neighbours twice a day, the book and audiobook, because I know these people who listen to podcasts generally can't be bothered to read books. So do just get the audiobook on Audible, is my book about growing up in the 90s and all the TV we watched. That is the end of the sales. Let's get on with the episode. It's a brand new type of episode when we take you back to just 1 month in the 90s. It is this month in 1996.
Hello and welcome to Quickly Kevin. This week's guest, Chris Skull.
How does that feel, Skull?
You're making it look easy. Making it look easy. I thought it took real talent. Turns out anyone could do it.
To use your native language. It's amazing, yeah. How
are you keeping, Chris? What have you been up to? No, etc. Right. So for this week, we thought we'd record a new... We've been looking for new formats. We're always looking to bring Quickly Kevin into... Well, we're not looking to bring Quickly Kevin into the modern age. That's the exact opposite of what we're trying to do. But we thought it'd be nice to do this month in the 90s. And then over the next 120 years, we'll do 120 of these episodes and judge which was the most important month for football in the 90s. We have chosen this month 25 years ago, September 1996. Guys, what were we all up to personally in September 1996?
You're starting school again, aren't you? You're starting school after a wonderful summer off.
I was starting year nine.
Yeah.
So I was going into my first SATs year.
In year nine, I was the top of the lower site. So our school was divided year 7, 8, and 9. You were kind of the kings of your little school there. So and then you'd go up and then year 10 was you had the upper site. So we owned the place at this point.
You just ascended to be to running the school.
Yeah,
were first you a cool school kid, Chris? Where were you in the social?
I think kind of the jester, and the bottom rung of the coolest group.
If you were a Premier League team, if your school was the Premier League, what team were you?
I think I was United, but I was Jordi Cruyff.
I don't even understand what that... Oh, so you were in a good team.
In a cool group, but yeah. the bottom of the pecking order.
So does that mean your dad was really cool, Scott? you were trading on his name for decades.
People say, your dad's the only reason you're in this cool group.
Do you know your dad's the coolest person to ever go to this school?
Yeah, you weren't allowed to have Skull on the back of your shirt. You took it off, Chris.
Well, do you know what? He does come up in this month.
Yeah, he does, actually. It's front of mind.
Yeah. What about you, Crane? Where were you? Who were you?
Which team was I? That's a tricky one, isn't it? I mean, I think I was pretty mid-table. It's a bit like you, Chris, really. I think maybe like a Tottenham of that sort of time, sort of mid-table. I was kind of...
Under Jerry Francis,
yeah, exactly, yeah.
You had the haircut as well, didn't you, Crane?
Exactly, yeah. Very big shirts. It was all kind of it was a weird time. But yeah, similar to you, sort of like a bit of a floater. I think that was kind of where I was at school.
Michael? Yeah.
Where was I in the hierarchy, or what was I doing in my life at this point in time?
Well, let's have both.
A little bit both. Well, I was just starting A-levels.
Slightly
older than you guys. So
this was
coming off the back of summer of 96, just starting A-levels. And I think
great time to be going into sick form, just off the back of Euro 96.
Well, I was thinking about it, and obviously we're going to sort of contain this to September, but that was probably the best August of my entire life.
I'm sorry, we won't be accepting August anecdotes.
I wanted to talk about losing my virginity, goddammit.
What a pre-season.
Yeah, unfortunately, I didn't find any form in the league. That's the problem.
Michael went to a water park with Chris Sutton on August the 1st, but he can't tell us about it. It was a great day.
What we're finding is that all of us were on the periphery of groups.
Well, where were you, Josh?
I was on the periphery of, I'd say, the second. So there was the coolest group that should be the sport people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Obviously, the kind of jocks. So I was nowhere near that. But then there was the music group, the kind of, which was based around the band Weedle, which was one of the school bands. And I was on the periphery of the people that liked music.
With me, you have to remember that my sort of defining characteristic was that I was the head choir boy at Bath Abbey. And then the Christmas before this, in 1995, at the Christmas assembly, I was forced to sing Jingle Bells in Spanish to the entire school. Which sort of did mark me quite a lot. It had quite an effect.
Defined
you. So there
you.
Was a brief... It did define me. And there was a period for about a year after that where, like, year sevens would sort of take the piss out of me, despite the fact I was a year nine. We go, sing us a song, mate. And people, there was a joke.
Sing us a song, mate.
I was Mr. Tobin's son. Mr. Tobin was the music teacher and a bit of a dork. And year sevens would come up to me and sing that thing, pia, pia, piano, piano, all this sort of stuff. It was a difficult time. But then gradually memories fade, don't they? And I think by September 1996, I was back to the middle again.
Oh, that's good. That's
good. Yeah, exactly. All things right, don't they?
Exactly.
What does Jingle Bell sound like in Spanish?
It goes, I think it's din don dan, vamos a Belém, nacido niño que rece todo bien. There you are. That's enough of it. But that's basically what I can remember.
Good.
Thank you very much.
That's really good. Now, what do they force you to do? It's great.
I'm now going to have quickly Kevin sort of people stopping me in the street going, are you that dork? You sang.
hey, you losers, sing Jingle Bells in Spanish.
To be thought of as a dork by the kind of people that are into Quickly Kevin is unbelievable.
That's
as well.
True. I mean, I've been to
this
your
is
live
the home
shows.
Of all. This is really shows. A refuge for dorks. Let's be honest. Four people that claim they're on the periphery of groups. Let's be honest.
Do you remember, Josh, when I went to see you guys play live at the Hackney Empire, and I looked out at your audience and I said to you, "You've got a type, haven't you?" And there's a certain type of person that listens to this, and I am one of those people. Hi. Anyway, yeah.
Well, shall we take ourselves back to the month before we get into the football stories by listening to what was going on that month?
So to come on ITV News, when it comes to video games, the more bits, the better, and the new machine from Nintendo is as good as it gets.
Down, put your hands up in the air, man. French and Germans are planning to sideline the City of London if Britain doesn't join the European single currency.
Ready or not, here I come, you can't hide.
Good evening. A controversial rap artist who led a troubled existence has lost his fight for life.
Gangster rap singer Tupac Shakur died tonight in a Las Vegas hospital.
You can't hide, gonna find you and make you want me. And I said, what about breakfast at Tiffany's? She said, I think I remember the film.
So that was the number ones of the month. With some of the big news stories as well. I'd say the thing that takes me back most, obviously, is Wannabe by the Spice Girls, because I vividly remember that. That was number one for 8 weeks.
Wow. I assumed it was number one for longer, actually. In my memory, like, most sort of successful number ones were there for months, but maybe that's just sort of Robin Hood effect. I've got that sort of memory of it. But 8 weeks, I'd assume it was there for, like,
eight
6 months
years.
Or something.
6 months? You assumed one of you by the Spice Girls was number one for 6 months.
I think my memory of listening to the radio on the way into school was basically you just listen to one song for about 4 months. It would just go round and round and round and round, and yeah. Then they'd move on to another one. That's basically what would happen.
Was your mum buying a single? Is that what was happening? Your mum bought a single every four
the tape
months.
Deck. Yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly. I've got a link to this. Actually, my hairdresser claims he was the bouncer in the video for Wannabe.
Oh, wow.
But he also told me he set up Posh and Beck, so I don't know really if I'm sure I believe it. He's told me a lot of things, to be honest.
Were you a fan of the Spice Girls?
It was really, I want to use the word refreshing when they burst onto the scene, wasn't it?
Yeah?
Yeah,
you like it refreshing.
Yeah, it was.
As a 13-year-old, you're like, at last, a breath of fresh air in the music industry.
I rocked back on my rocking chair with my cigar and my cognac at 13 years old. I thought, this is refreshing.
Isn't this nice?
This is just the Philip we need in the
young people just having a good time. And is there anything wrong with that?
At bloody last, if you ask me.
And it's girl power, not just... It's a positive message, and I'm behind it, 100%.
Yeah. What had you been listening to before that, then, Skull? What was your... Why had this been so refreshing?
Why were you so parched?
Yeah, I was listening to a lot of... Was Robbie Williams had just started his solo career around here?
Yeah, I suppose.
I was listening to him. I think Blur... Is Blur Country House, is that around here?
That was 95, yeah.
95. So, you know, it's a bit samey, isn't it? Like, it's just different. It was different.
It's just a bit different.
We were ready for a change culturally. Do you know what? You know, we were talking about 8 weeks at number one doesn't feel enough. Is that because the yardstick for a 90s number one is I Will Always Love You, which was number one? Like, you always judge
well,
how long
no,
a number
that's
one
not
is.
The, there's that. Two bigger number one, two longer number ones in the 90s than that.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, Everything Brian I Adams. Do, I Do It For You by Bryan Adams.
Yeah.
And Love Is All Around by Wet, Wet, Wet.
Wow, was number one for eight? How long?
I think both of them were number one for about 16 weeks.
Bloody, that's a long time, isn't it?
Have you had this sort of relationship with a lot of these songs? At the time, I hated them because you heard them so much. But then as time passes and now you hear them more rarely, it's like, oh, yeah, there has a nostalgia thing. So my relationship with these, like, for instance, Wet, Wet, Wet is a good example. I literally couldn't stand that song. I hated it so much.
But now you listen to it every morning, don't you?
And I find it refreshing. I find it refreshing, girl.
Breath of fresh air.
In the shower, having a cold drink, listening to Wet, Wet, Wet. And what a perfect song for the shower as well, Wet, Wet, Wet. It's,
lovely.
Thank you very much.
Topping up with a bit of Skag as well.
I didn't like the Spice Girls because I by the age of 13, and I'm sure, I bet Michael's the same with this, that I felt like I was too into bands that played their own instruments and took themselves seriously to entertain that I'd be a fan of a pop band like the Spice Girls. Was that the same with you, Michael?
I mean, it was quite a seismic thing in my house because I grew up in a house that was... I got two sisters who are a little bit younger than me, but it was huge. Like, for them, it was on nonstop. My mum was also quite a young mum, so she was also a fan. And then our house was the sort of pre-going out house. So 3 nights a week, it would be filled with teenage girls all getting ready. So my life was an endless soundtrack of whatever. First of all, it was New Kids on the Block, and then it's Take That, then it was the Spice Girls. So I'm sort of similarly, it felt like it was around for much longer than it was. But I was a fan. At that time, I was pretending that I was a fan of, you know, dipping my toe in Blur and Oasis. I was sort of flirting with Smashing Pumpkins and Weezer, the Blue Album. But because none of my friends or family were really into music, I was a closet diva fan, so I loved like Mariah Carey, Gloria Estefan, Eternal, and obviously Louise Newedding was a big person then. So I had to pretend like, oh yeah, God, yeah, Nirvana, Kurt Cobain, can't believe he's dead. Secretly listening to "I Could Turn Back Time" by Cher on my Walkman.
Absolutely amazing.
This is the first time this has come up, isn't it? Your love, like people we describe as divas.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely love a diva. Early 90s Mariah Carey. Yep, yes, please.
I did a gig once at the Ministry of Sound, which they had a very short-lived comedy night there, and the manager of Eternal tried to sign me afterwards, which would have been such a weird... I don't know how he'd have used me in a way that would have been just a dramatic career change.
Was he looking to replace Louise? Is that why he's
asking? Oh my God, that would have been amazing.
How did that happen? Did he hear you singing Jingle Bells in Spanish and then go,
oh, that's what it was.
Know that new sound you're looking for? Well, listen to this.
I'm so refreshed. It's interesting though, Josh, you were saying there about that. I think that's true because when you're a teenager, so much of your identity at that point is wrapped up in music and what that says about you, because you're 14. What identity can you really have? Your parents pay for all your food, you can't drive, you can't do anything. So it's like, it's so important. So to admit you like these other things are a big thing. I was exactly like that. I was very much, you know, Oasis, Blur, all this sort of stuff, but mainly because I didn't really have much of a personality at that point that I was confident in. So I thought you'd wrap yourself around these things that you thought reflected you in a good right.
Totally. But now I would say I would challenge anyone to find a better top five on Spotify than the Spice Girls songs. Anyway, let's move on. This was the launch of the N64 this month, which was... any of you have an N64?
I did,
Mega Drive.
You had a Mega
Drive? Sega all the way.
Really? Michael? Yeah. Michael, you were a PC, were you?
No, I mean, I pretty much had every console at some point, but the N64, in particular GoldenEye, was, defined 97 to 2000 for me. There's nothing I played more, apart from Championship Manager, than GoldenEye.
And the best of Gloria Estefan. I adored the N64. I got it for Christmas. It would have been Christmas 96 or Christmas 97. I've got no idea. With Diddy Kong Racing, where I could do every track on Diddy Kong Racing. Like they're burned into my mind.
Yeah.
If you gave me a controller now, I think I could thrash almost anyone at Diddy Kong Racing now. It's the thing in my life that I'm best at in the whole world.
It sounds like you're sort of trying to impress a girl when you're 18. And you're failing. If you gave me a controller now, I could thrash you easily, and I know all the courses. So yeah. Anyway, I'll leave my number here. Get in contact if you're interested.
It's amazing that it had the opposite effect in those days, isn't it?
I agree. I think Diddy Kong Racing is, for me, I'm going to say, I think it's more enjoyable than Mario Kart.
Wow.
Yeah, I think it's the best game I've ever played.
Wow.
I think it's amazing. And I had also ISS 64 that was absolutely phenomenal football game. So let's move on to the football game. Did any of you have ISS 64?
Yeah, I loved it.
Incredible.
Absolutely loved it.
It was so good. It was one of those football games. I don't know if that still happens in FIFA now, but every football game in the 90s, you could work out the easiest way to score a goal.
Yeah.
And then once you'd worked out, and on ISS 64, you needed to get down the side and then run across the front of the penalty area. Like you're kind of cutting in from the wing and then just shooting to the goal.
Is it true that I could give you a controller now and you could score against anyone in any style you wanted? 100%, is that true?
100%.
You just do it and you knew how to score with every team against every team. But it's true. It also represented such a step up. From my mind, soccer, basically, where it was just one pixel running around. And then suddenly it was like, this is real football. It felt
like real football.
Such a big change.
It was amazing. It also had the ability to edit players in. And what it did if you edit players in now to FIFA, you can just give them, I don't know if you can still do this, but when I last played FIFA, you can just give them whatever stats they want. This way, it would give you an amount of stat and you'd get to share it around their attributes. So you'd have to decide what each player, like, you'd have to balance the players up, create a team. It was fucking wonderful. I loved it. I loved that game so much. I'd say it's my favourite ever football computer game, actually.
Wow.
There you go, I've said it.
It's interesting you say best game you've ever played. Have you ever gone back and tried to play it again? Because I played GoldenEye on the N64 about 3 years ago, and it was not as good as I remembered. In fact, yeah. It was really hard to play.
Oh, really?
Michael?
Well, I haven't revisited GoldenEye for a very long time for that very reason.
Don't go back.
I don't want it to be tarnished. Like, I love that game so much, and very much like Josh, I was unplayable at GoldenEye. And I think part of it came down to, you remember the N64 joypads have got that three kind of pronged, almost like fork design?
Yeah.
And you're supposed, most people hold the middle prong, which is where the controller the joystick bit is. Yeah. So the left-hand side bit is almost slightly redundant. I didn't. I used to hold it from each side because my fingers are so long. I could basically, my thumbs can reach and my fingers underneath can reach every button. And when you're playing GoldenEye, the way you have to strafe using those yellow buttons in the top corner, the sort of top right corner, the yellow arrow button, it meant that I could sort of glide with a speed and efficiency like I was on ice that no one else could. It was like I was just rollerblading around the maps. I was like,
you're listening to Show Off Pod with Josh Widdicombe and Michael Marden, who apparently can do everything on any computer game ever.
I was so good at GoldenEye, when I was at university, they would make me play it with my hands behind my back. And then after that, they made me play it with
What, with your nose?
No. I would be playing it. I would be holding it, but the joypad wouldn't be in front of me. It would be like behind me. That was the only way to try and handicap me. And then, they used to do, it would be 3-on-1. So like they wouldn't kill each other. All they could do was kill me. And I would still win every single game. That's how fucking good I am at GoldenEye.
Yeah, but on the other side, you were really into Gloria Estefan, which did bring you down in the sort of, in the cool ratings.
It is a bit like a Bond villain, isn't it? Like some crazy guy just listening to divas all day long and killing people. They can't get him.
Because of his long thumbs.
Because of his long thumbs, yeah.
GoldenEye was one of the first games that made good use of the Rumble Pack. Remember the Rumble
Pack?
Yeah,
the Rumble Pack was the biggest piece of dog shit of all time.
Yeah, it was so pointless, but it was quite good in that game.
Yeah, it would just vibrate. So if you had it in for ISS 64, if you got tackled, it would vibrate. You're like, that's not making me feel like I've been tackled.
There was also a rumour that went around school that my friend Rob used to put it down his pants and get repeatedly shot on GoldenEye. That's true. But he'd do it on purpose.
He'd invite Michael round, which is the only person that could actually get him to climax. He was so good.
Oh, no, you got me again. I can't believe it.
You're not the only rule is you're not allowed to use a golden gun. It has to be what the weapon with the most bullets. Sustain firing for as long as possible. Yeah, my main memory of GoldenEye is the guy who got shot on the loo. Remember that? You used to climb on top. There's a guy who was on the toilet. Shoot him. That was a great moment
in the facility, the best level.
Let's move on to football because that's what we're here for. We've created a lovely image of September 1996 with some strange details about our lives. But Skull, take us through September 1996 in the Premier League.
In September 1996, one team's form sticks out amongst everyone else. It begins like this. Wimbledon, under Joe Kinnear, beat Spurs at home 1-0. Following week, they're smashing Everton at home 4-0. They go from there. They go to the Mighty Hammers. They win away from home 2-0. And then they go on a little bit later that month to Southampton at home. They win 3-1.
This is mad.
And so, and then last game of the month, they play away to Derby County, win 2-0.
They won every game.
Won every game. Smashed
every
game. Are
they top of the league?
They're not. I think they had such a poor start that by the end of September, they are a mere fifth place. So they finished the month on 15 points with a plus 5 goal difference. But that only gets them to fifth. 5 points off Liverpool, who are 20 points clear, who have 20 points. That'd be absurd.
That would go down in history as one of the greatest starts, followed by the biggest choke of all time.
20 points
clear by the end of September. I know we'd like joke about like Wimbledon being like the crazy gang and all that, but there was this period in the mid-90s when they became less crazy gangy and started to be taken a bit more seriously as a genuinely good Premier League team.
Yeah, it's a couple of years on from this, isn't it?
So who was in that? So that would be like Ivan Leonhardsen and people like that were playing. Is that right?
You'd have Robbie Earl, you'd have Marcus Gale. you'd have probably had Dean Holdsworth would probably be in that team.
Yeah.
Was it Wimbledon who, on the first day of the season, David Beckham scored the lob against? It was, wasn't
it? Yes,
it
was. Yeah. That's right.
Did you like or hate Wimbledon?
Yeah, that was what I was going to ask you. I quite like the fact that they didn't own a ground. There was something quite charming about the fact they just played at Selhurst Park, didn't they? At that, yeah. They were sort of ground sharing as Crystal Palace, and they didn't spend much money. And I quite like that aspect, but they were rather the crazy gang. They're quite unpleasant gang. The more you hear about it,
yeah,
stuff you sort of,
that's not got the same ring to it.
Not
has
very
it?
Nice gang. And you read the more you read about it, I would have hated to have hung out with these guys.
Yeah, basically. Awful.
So
people.
I sort of mixed feeling. Also, I remember their chairman. What's he called?
Sam Hammam.
Sam Hammam was he always seemed quite objectionable.
Well, can I read you the lineup for the, this is their last win of that month, a 2-0 win away at Derby. Neil Sullivan in goal. You really get the impression.
That a good goalie. Really good goalie.
This is really is Crazy Gang 2.0. Kenny Cunningham, Brian McAllister, Chris Perry, Marcus Gayle, Alan Kimball, not from The Fugitive, Neil Ardley, Robbie Earl, Vinnie Jones, Øyvind Leonardsen, Efanikoku up front. And get this for a sub.
Efanikoku.
Coming on for Efanikoku in the 89th minute. Mick Harford. Another one where it feels like he's in the wrong era here.
Yeah. I felt like there was a group of teams, Wimbledon, Coventry, Southampton, they who are always in the bottom half of the Premier League. And because they'd always been there when I was watching football, when they then went on to get relegated, I couldn't quite believe it was allowed and it was happening. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I was like, it felt to me like, well, things are never going to be the same again without Coventry in the Premier League. And then instantly you get used to it. But it felt to me like this isn't the thing that's meant to happen. They're not meant to actually go down, these teams. I thought I wasn't used to new churn in the Premier League. I liked it to remain more or less exactly the same throughout the 90s. And it made me feel very unsettled when these teams left.
You're right. But when we would have got relegated, it was a genuinely sad day. Wasn't it?
Yeah.
I don't even know why. And it's not like I particularly loved them. It just felt like, oh, a piece of the 90s is disappearing here.
It was completely. Like when you go, oh my, it was that moment when you go, I'm going to be dead one day. Time moves on. Suddenly, your own mortality was shown to you. If Wimbledon go down, then I can age. Do you know what I mean? This is...
One thing I did like about those sort of ugly teams in the 90s, I say ugly in the way that they played traditionally, was often, normally a central midfielder, there was one quite flairy player who was brilliant. So like Robbie Earl, I thought was fantastic.
Obviously, he was brilliant.
Letitier at Southampton. You have Kinklatse, who would have been, before he, there was always that one guy in the middle who was so crucial in a way that it's not really the case anymore. And they stayed there for a little while. And I always quite exciting. You had all these sort of, you know, hard tackling Ben Thatchers will break your jaw types. And then this is one person who was the hope. JJ Okocha, for example, when he was at Bolton, although that's a weird one because they brought in Djorkaeff and a few of these players that made it a bit more finesse.
Sam Allardyce. I know Michael and Chris would defend Sam Allardyce to their dying day as the greatest England manager who's ever lived. But he probably doesn't get the respect he deserves, the amount of flair players he kind of had at Bolton.
Here we go.
Yeah.
He had many ways of playing.
Yeah, they're all flair players with about 6 months of their career left to go. Though,
yeah, of course.
Very much.
That's true.
Players who'd now be in China, basically.
I've got another astonishing stat about Wimbledon this season we're talking about here. So they'd lost their first three games of the season. So they played three games in August. They lost at home to Man United 3-0. That was the Beckham game, I think.
Yeah.
And then lost away to Newcastle 2-0. Lost away to Leeds 1-0.
That's an awful start, though. Like, tough fixtures.
So as we've established, they won every game in September. And get this, they didn't lose another game until the 22nd of December. They won or drawn. By the time the 22nd of December turns up, they're third in the league.
No,
wow. Yes. And when they do get beat, they get absolutely thumped by Villa 5-0.
Oh, wow.
It's funny that, isn't it, how teams can just put a massive run together like that out of nowhere.
And I wonder if at that point anyone's going, are Wimbledon going to do this? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The other interesting thing is you say Liverpool were top on 20 points and you imagine that Liverpool were nothing to do with ever winning the league in the 90s. But there were points when their fans genuinely believed that they were going to win the league, I think. I think the big stories, though, in the Premier League that month, though, weren't the results, but there was two huge managerial changes. Firstly, let's start with possibly one of the biggest moments in the history of the Premier League, Arsene Wenger joining Arsenal. Do you remember this happening?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Vividly.
I remember having absolutely no idea who he was. Same with everyone else and the rest of the press. Like, who is this weird dweeby sort of professor guy
that's coming from the guy that complained
while listening to Gloria Estefan.
Apparently Arsene Wenger can write a team sheet with both hands tied behind his back. Apparently he can do it on a piece of paper and he'll definitely get the right team and he will win. So
I never said they were tied behind my back. That was Street Fighter 2 that they had to tie my hands behind my back. But the main thing I remember about Arsene Wenger being appointed was to do with his predecessor Stuart Houston.
Yes.
Who, for me, is the sort of archetypal caretaker manager when you just know that they're not up to the job.
Yeah.
Like, you know, when a sort of an assistant manager steps in and whether they want the job or not, their first from their first press conference, they're almost like a supply teacher that comes in and has lost the room before they've even got to their desk.
Yeah.
You're like, completely. Oh, this is going to be carnage. This is a free-for-all. And he always had that sort of defeated look of certain assistant or caretaker managers where you're like, oh, dude, sorry, mate.
Surely they always have some like long-term attachment to the club as well, don't they? Normally, they've been there for ages and they've done the under-21s and all this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
This sort of idea that they might have a chance, but we all know those years count for nothing.
Also, you're not in this job. If you've worked at a club in a cushy job for 15 years, and you get made caretaker, and then you win three games, and they offer you the manager's job, do not take it. because your luck won't last, and then you'll get sacked as manager, and then you've no longer got a job.
Yeah.
Just stick with your easy job.
Well, you can't risk nothing. That's the take-home
risk
message.
Risk nothing in your life. That is my tip.
If an assistant gets made manager, and then it goes bad, like gets made permanent manager, and then it goes wrong, your career's over, isn't it? No one ever goes, oh, well, he might still be good. It's like you've had one shot and it's not worked out.
Yeah. Well, let's. I'm glad you brought up Stuart Houston, Michael, because I thought we've discussed Wenger enough. So let's look at the other side of this. So I've drilled down into Stuart Houston. He was caretaker when George Graham left and then Bruce Rioch got the job. Bruce Rioch, who, as manager of Arsenal for a year, is one of the great forgotten men of Quickly Kevin. We never mentioned Bruce Rioch.
Yeah.
It's a shame.
He lasted a year and then he got sacked in the summer, and they just gave Houston the caretaker manager at the start of the season because Wenger couldn't start until September.
Oh, wow.
And then, get this, Stuart Houston gets the job at QPR as manager from his work as caretaker at Arsenal. So he leaves, and Pat Rice has to take over as caretaker before Arsene Wenger turns up.
Oh, wow. I don't remember any of that.
There is another twist.
Yeah, the best twist of all is Stuart Houston takes the job at QPR and appoints as his assistant Bruce Rioch.
Oh, lovely. Lovely.
Imagine that reversal. How awkward that is. Bruce Rioch saying, I think we should do this. And Stuart Houston going, yeah, mate, but the tables have turned and I make the decisions now.
That's amazing. Didn't Bruce Rioch, I think Bruce Rioch, actually, did he sign Bergkamp? Is that right? And some of these players?
It's
like this idea that Wenger came in and bought, but he actually didn't. A few of these signings were to do with Rioch.
Well, I think the long rumour is that Bruce Rioch was already unknowingly keeping the seat warm for a year.
Yes.
And so Bergkamp was actually already earmarked by, you know how Man City were signing players because they knew Guardiola was going to show up? Do you remember when that was? Yeah. I think the rumour was that Bergkamp, and I think it was Platt was the other one they signed at that point, were Arsene Wenger pointed out signings already. But I don't know if that's true.
Okay.
Do email in if you know the answer to that.
I heard that Wenger came in and there was a post-it note on the desk and it had loads of stuff. It said, like, keep an eye on Thierry Henry. I think this kid might be good and stuff like this. It's real written down. Also, maybe more passing football with two French central midfielders might work. That's what Rioch had written.
Can I read you a quote from Bruce Rioch, which I think is the most 90s quote of all time? This is a quote from Bruce Rioch when he was sacked as assistant manager of QPR. I think this, to me, is the most 90s sentence that's ever been uttered. I was at home watching the Louise Woodward case on television when I turned on CFAX and read that I had been sacked. Isn't that?
That's fun. Really
isn't
90s.
That the most perfect quote you've ever heard in your life? The thought that Bruce Riott was at home watching the Louise Woodward case, not knowing that his life was about to change unutterably.
It feels like, Josh, it feels like an author is doing the first line of his book where he wants to make it clear it's set in the 90s without actually saying it's set in the 90s. How can I hide this behind language?
Yeah, I began to sweat. My global hypercolour t-shirt changed colour.
I've got a bit on Arsenal. Yeah. I have got a bit of something seminal moment happens in this month, September 1996. Patrick Vieira makes his debut for Arsenal.
Does he?
Wow. But also, another interesting thing is Patrick Vieira and Remy Gard had been signed by Arsenal before Wenger was announced as the manager.
Oh, there we go.
And the rumour was...
Were they Stuart Houston spots?
And Stuart Houston doesn't get the credit for the French Revolution. It's a crying shame.
What's the real sadness for QPR fans is if they'd got Stuart Houston a bit earlier, presumably he'd have signed Vieira and Remy Gard for them.
The 90s would have been very different.
Shall we talk about the other managerial change of September 96? There's a lot of events going on, isn't there? Vieira's debut.
Yeah, exciting month. Wenger.
George Graham, the former Arsenal manager, replaces Howard Wilkinson at Leeds.
Mm-hmm.
And when I read that, I couldn't believe that Howard Wilkinson was still manager of Leeds in 1996. He was there for all of that start of the Premier League, and I don't think I have any memory of Leeds from that team to the Lee Bowyer team. It's like a complete black hole to me.
George Graham to Leeds, it feels like, I remember that at the time thinking, this just feels right, though.
Yeah, it was very on the nose, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was great casting.
Yeah, it's perfect. Well, it worked with Don Revy, so let's do it again.
We're a bit of a shithouse of a club. Let's look around. Who's the biggest shithouse manager? There he is. Get him in.
Yeah.
Well, interestingly, so Howard Wilkinson leaves Leeds in September 1996. But did you know this? A year before, in the summer of 95, Howard Wilkinson was approached about the Arsenal job. And he wanted to go, but Leeds said no.
Oh, wow.
And 1 year later, his stock has fallen so low, he's out the door.
I remember Howard Wilkinson became, after that, a kind of looming threat every time the England manager's job came up.
Yeah.
Because he became a bit of an FA suit, didn't he? I think he might have even been, he might have even taken over for a couple of games when someone resigned. And I always thought, please not Howard Wilkinson. He just felt so uniquely uninspiring as a personality.
I know. He really is. Like, whenever I picture Howard Wilkinson, he's just grey skin.
Yeah.
Grey, like, dead behind the eyes. Monotonous tone.
He wasn't dissimilar to John Major, was he? Do you know what I mean? Like, in terms of the era. The success in 1992 they shared, and then they both kind of greyly carried on for a few more years.
But there's a lot of managers from that period that could only really have worked in that period. Like Kinnear, you mentioned earlier, is exactly the same. Obviously a different sort of personality, but they're so of the mid-90s.
Yeah.
That you would never... I think Allardyce is, as you say, he's a bit of a legacy, but of that time for some reason. He feels like that.
Yeah.
But there's just so many of these managers that you just would never see now. It just wouldn't happen.
Howard Wilkinson as well, very great. This, I feel like this was the era of the, like, dead-skinned manager. She also had Brian Little. Do you remember Brian Little? Like, I used to think there was something wrong with pictures of Brian Little because it's like, there's no colour in his face.
Do email in if you've got any more dead-skinned managers. Dead-skinned 90s managers, do email them in.
Joe Kinnear, when he came to Newcastle many, many years later, there was that weird appointment. And that was a perfect example of, I think, how far the game had moved on. Someone had transplanted a sort of iconic 90s football manager into the modern game. And you're like, even his press conferences, you're like, what the fuck is this guy talking about? It was like, all right, granddad.
Yeah. Do you know what it felt like? You know, in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, when they like take Genghis Khan bowling and it's like... now, we've done Manager of the Month, and I think the other thing that obviously marks out a month is Goal of the Month. And this month, it was Karol Poborski against Leeds.
Ian Rush getting in front of his marker there. David Beckham, look at that. He's everywhere. And a good pass too to Cantona. That changes the
Liverpool, shape of the play, and here's Karol Poborski right through on goal for Manchester United, and that just about seals it. It's 3-0, and Cantona congratulated by his colleagues, as is Poborski.
Michael, as the Man U fan, I'll be honest, I have no memory of this goal, and I don't want to rile you up before you speak, but I think it's the worst goal of the month I've ever seen.
When I watched it, I was, because it's, I think it was a 4-0 win against Leeds, he scores it. And I was watching the highlights of that whole match.
It was the game that got Howard Wilkinson sacked.
Yeah.
Wow.
And the goal is so underwhelming as a goal, I just presumed he scores another goal. And that's the goal that was going to be the goal of the month. So when I think possibly Cantona scores the fourth, I was just like, oh no, hold on a minute, I'm going to have to rewind and watch that again. It was just... It's just fine. It's just fine. It's just like, it's just a goal. There isn't a bit of skill. There's a nice through ball from Cantona and like a fairly conventional finish from Poborski. I was like, oh, well, he's obviously going to chip him. He's obviously going to chip him.
I thought he was going to do a chip. Poborski I thought he was going to do a like a self-referential chip of the goal.
Yeah.
The old scoop boot out.
Like, I can't believe there weren't better goals than that. That month. That's crazy, because in my memory of goal of the month, and I used to love it, it was the highlight of match of the day for me, was that, oh, these are just going to be banger after banger. Like, oh, what's Bergkamp doing this? What's Letizia doing this month? It was dreadful.
You know, everyone always talks about like, oh, what, this month was a great month for goal of the month. And like, sometimes you see those highlight, like a random 90s month. And it's like, wow, every goal was good. Where were the month where every goal is bad?
Well, this month.
This must be what the worst ever month for goal of the month.
Yeah.
If that's winning, like to beat 10 other goals, and it's that bad.
To give
bad.
You an idea, the eighth goal was a penalty.
Have you seen it? September's goal of the month.
No, I'd love to watch it. If anyone's got September 96's goal of the month.
If I was the producer of Match of the Day, I would go, I think we just skip goal of the month this month. Do you want to? I think we just leave it out. It's fine.
Just don't mention
we'll come
it
back next month. Nobody's gonna notice.
Everyone's tired from the Euros.
Exactly. Yeah.
I've got a theory on this goal of the month. You know when Al Pacino won an Oscar for Scent of a Woman because of his previous work.
Yeah.
Is this a kind of, they're giving it to Poborski because they feel he should have got something for that goal at Euro 96. And they feel he deserves a goal of the month. He's never had one. Or was the excitement around Karol Poborski so much at this point? Bear in mind, presumably the goal of the month for August was David Beckham's goal against Wimbledon, the most iconic goal of the 90s.
Yeah.
What a come down. But do you think the excitement around Poborski was so much that people just...
Oh, that's like, it's interesting.
Do you know what I mean? In a bit like currently people are just think anything Cristiano Ronaldo does is just a stroke of genius because the excitement about him being here is so much.
How did you feel, Michael, when Poborski joined Man United? Were you thinking, oh, this is brilliant, we've got this guy who's amazing.
It's one of those ones, and we've covered this obviously a lot on the podcast, where pre-internet, the sort of not knowing about a player going into an international tournament and then having... I don't even think Poborski had a good tournament. I think that was a very lucky goal that he scored in Euro 96. He got a few fortunate bounces. But because it was a foreign player that you knew nothing about, it was definitely a sense of excitement. I think the
such
problem
such a non-Ferguson signing as well, wasn't it?
Well, we had sold Kanchelskis the year before, which I think was a mistake because he went on to have a brilliant few years at Everton after that. But then Beckham came through the season before and then obviously scored that goal against Wimbledon. So Poborski never really got the chance that he thought he would because Beckham's ascendancy was just sort of so quick and so amazing. So I, as a Manchester United fan, see him as a little bit of a flop. He was there for less than two seasons before he sold him to Benfica. So I don't remember being excited. I mean, my main thing about that summer was that we had lost Alan Shearer. Like, Shearer went to Newcastle. And had he gone to United, I think we probably would have won every Premier League until he retired.
Would you like to hear the top 10 transfers of that summer in England to give you a feeling? I'd say it's possibly everyone. Well, it's an iconic summer of transfers. So from 10 to what? No, let's start at 1 because we know it's Alan Shearer to Newcastle, 15 million.
Yeah.
Ravanelli to Middlesbrough, 7 million.
Oh.
Di Matteo to Chelsea, 4.5 million. Poborski to Man U, 3.6. Emerson to Middlesbrough, 3.5. Gary Speed to Everton, 3.4. Bowyer to Leeds, 3 million.
Mm.
Gary McAllister to Coventry, 3 million.
Wow.
Andy Booth to Sheffield Wednesday, 2.7 million. Frank Leboeuf to Chelsea, 2.5 million. It's mad that neither Liverpool or Arsenal or Blackburn have got a player in the top 10 signings.
Frank Leboeuf's an interesting one there. He was a superb player, and he represented a different type of defender that was starting to come in at that point, didn't he? He was good with his feet, could find a pass. It's just, I remember him thinking he was just fantastic.
Did Frank Leboeuf remind anyone of RoboCop when he's got his helmet off? I've always thought it.
Can I just compare? Bear in mind, Andy Booth was 2.7 million, Boya 3 million, etc. Right? Can I just take you through a few of the Italian ones? So, top, the most expensive Italian incoming was Chiesa to Parma for 10 million, Boxic to Juventus 6 million, Turam to Parma 4.5. The 10th most expensive Italian transfer, 3.2 million, was Zinedine Zidane to Juventus.
That's insane.
Just 500,000 more than Andy Booth.
That's insane. Boy, that's crazy. Because that implies that the money is knocking around the English game, doesn't it? And then, so why aren't they just going... how do they not know to try and make a play for Zidane? Or is he just not interested?
Well, he has ended up at Juventus, which, I mean, so they may have been interested. I mean, Juventus obviously were and still are huge, so that may have been a deciding factor.
Yeah, I don't think he was presented with the option of Sheffield Wednesday and Juventus. Wednesday didn't have him lined up, but chose Andy Booth instead.
But that's also, you get a real sense of the rapid inflation of transfer fees, like Shearer being 15 million that summer, and then the next most expensive transfer being half of that amount was the first example. But 2 years later, I think, or roughly 2 years later, Zidane sold for 40 something million to Real Madrid.
Yeah.
Sheffield Wednesday missed out again then, didn't they? Yeah. Poor guys. They even offered a swap featuring Andy Booth. They were just going for Juventus, not interested.
Just one thing on Frank Leboeuf. When you Google Frank Leboeuf, it says Frank Leboeuf, French actor.
Oh, he's done really?
He's done a Dion Dublin, hasn't he? He's just reinvented it.
He popped up in something that I had watched.
The theory of everything. He's in the theory of everything.
Yes, that's it. That's the theory of everything.
Frank Leboeuf's in the theory of everything.
He plays Stephen Hawking's doctor.
What? Imagine watching that. Did you just see him and go, is that Frank Leboeuf?
No, I watched that film, and in my mind's eye, I can see him now, but I didn't clock it was Frank. You're not watching a film like that expecting Frank Leboeuf to turn up.
Yeah, of course.
I was watching it in the cinema, and I turned to my partner and said, that guy looks like Frank Leboeuf. And she just went, who the fuck is Frank Leboeuf?
Wow, that is a phenomenal great piece of trivia. One final seismic event I'd like to finish with. This month saw Glenn Hoddle's first game as England manager, a 3-0 win in Moldova, which was the debut of both David Beckham and Andy Hinchcliffe, which, you know, two men who went to patrol the wings for England for the next decade.
I really rated Andy Hinchcliffe back in the day, though, I must admit. He used to get so many assists, and he was fantastic from a corner and from free kicks. I really, really rated him.
Yeah, I presumed Andy Hinchcliffe was going to be a big deal.
Yeah. I thought that's our left-back issue sorted. I really thought he's brilliant. He'll be at United, he'll be, you know, whatever. But it didn't work out, obviously. But I thought it was brilliant.
This England Moldova game, this really did feel like the rebirth of England. I remember it being a massive deal.
Because it was the first game after Euro 96. I don't remember many qualifiers, but I do remember this being quite a big thing.
And a big famous debut in it, David Beckham.
Is 3-0 against Moldova a good result? Or how are they looking at that? Is that basically, you know, we've scraped that. It should be.
No, I think that's a solid
7-0.
Win. I don't think...
Is it?
No, I don't think Moldova were that bad. Were they?
Okay. Not a San Marino, are they? They're not.
No, they're not a San Marino.
They're going to give you a game.
Name your top three Moldovan players, then.
Probably Sergei Belus, seeing as I've got the starting lineup in front of me.
Okay. To my mind, you should be winning that 6 or 7-0.
Let's have a look at the group that they're in. So Moldova finished bottom with 0 points.
Yeah, there you go.
And a goal difference of minus 19.
Okay.
Yeah, and you know, interestingly, when England thrashed Moldova 4-0 at Wembley, two of the goals scored by Ian Wright. I can't in my mind's eye picture him ever scoring for England.
No, he played for England against Italy in that win, but he didn't go to the World Cup. Now, really, this month, it's David Beckham's debut for England. Wannabe is number one. Does this feel like it was
the month that began a whole new era for the country.
This 90s 2.0.
Arsene Wenger coming in as well. That's
Arsene Wenger coming in.
Hugely sort of catalytic.
Glenn Hoddle taking over England.
Joe Kinnear winning 5 games. This is a huge month.
Frank Leboeuf getting to grips with the language, laying the foundations for his cinematic career.
Michael mastering Goldeneye with his long thumbs. Well, I feel like we should score it so we can compare it to, in terms of importance and quality, how much are you going to take off for goal of the month? So give me your score. Everyone write down their score. So scoring it, there's 4 judges. It's basically like Strictly style scoring, okay. I suppose. But I want you to show your workings. Should we start with Crane?
I'm going high. I'm giving it a 9.
A 9?
Wow.
Yeah.
Bearing in mind that other months contain international tournaments.
Yes, this is true. But for me, it's the Wenger point. And in terms of what that represented for the changing shape of the game and the style in which we became accustomed to. I think it was just he was such an important figure. Whatever you think of the end of his Arsenal days, what he did in terms of changing the English game is huge. I think he was so fundamental to everything that exists now in our game. That's why I give it a 9. And I worry he would have given it a 10 if it wasn't for Baborski, to be honest. I've knocked off one for that. But I think it's so crucial. He's such a crucial figure. And I loved him back then. I loved the players he brought in. I found they were such an exciting team. And so I've gone 9.
I'm going to go 8 because I think there's a lot of important things. The debut of David Beckham, the launch of the N64, Wannabe, Glenn Hoddle, Wenger, obviously. But I don't believe that there's many iconic games, and everything that we're talking about is outside of football. Do you know what I mean? There's no actual on-pitch moments, so I'm going to give it an 8.
I think I'm going to give it a 7. Not because I disagree with anything that's been said. I just feel like the seeds were being planted in this month. We weren't sort of yet to see the fruit or the blossom of the flowers as a result of it. So it's hard to sort of really appreciate what it was in the moment and in hindsight. But I have just remembered talking about Goldeneye there and A-levels earlier. I failed my design A-level. And the reason I failed it is because based on my love of Goldeneye, not particularly Bond, but Goldeneye, my end of A-level project was I was going to build a James Bond themed crazy golf course that could be moved in and out like it was modular during the weather. And basically I just didn't do it throughout the whole year. And then right at the end, I made something out of MDF. And because I had no design skills at all, I stuck it together with double-sided sellotape. And when it came to like the grading, my design teacher picked it up and it sort of all just fell apart in his hands because it was just stuck together. And he said to me, looked me in the eyes and said, "You are a disgrace to the design profession."
Chris?
Well, I was going to give this a 9. I think it's a seminal month for all the reasons we've discussed, but I'm going to knock a point off. I'm going to knock a point off because of one of the number ones this month was responsible for perhaps one of the worst moments of my life. Now, on the Patreon Valentine special we did, you may have remembered that I talked about a girl that I used to fax a lot, literally fax.
Yeah.
This same girl, I think it was in this month, we had a school disco and I was plucking up the courage. The faxing had kind of died down. I thought, I'm going to pluck up the courage to ask her for a dance. And I'm sure it was in this month because I hadn't heard this song that was number 1. I asked her for a dance as this song began and she looked at me and said, "This isn't a slow song." And just walked off. Oh. It was Deep Blue Something, Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Oh.
It starts slow and it picks up. It's totally inappropriate for a slow dance. You're never going to pop your hands on the bum to that. You look like a fool if you tried to slow dance it.
Do you think about that every time you hear
Deep Blue? Every time. And
really?
When I saw it was number 1 this month, my heart just sank a bit. I can't be giving it 9 points from memory like that. I'm glad Deep Blue Something never did anything else. They deserve it. The room was ruined my life. So 8 points, September 96.
It's an overall score of 32 for September 1996. I've thoroughly enjoyed travelling back there. It's been a very pleasant experience.
Very much so. Yeah, it's been great.
I look forward to travelling back to a different month and a different time. And Chris, as a guest, will you come back on the show again?
I'd love to. I'd love to come back anytime.
That was September 1996, a glorious month. I do look forward to doing one where it's just a really shit month and we all give it like 3 out of 10. Oh, yeah, it was really bad. It was like April.
It's like a pre-season one. There's no football.
Yeah, July. July 1997.
A couple of celebrity deaths and sort of economics worries, basically, yeah.
If you have any months you want to suggest for that you would think would be great months for us to do, do email in and we'll try and do some more of those episodes in upcoming series. Tom Crane's podcast, My Favourite Takeaway, is available now on all your podcast apps. We haven't got time for a quiz this week, sadly. But we should also say we made an error last week. We were sent a quiz that we thought a listener had come up with, but it was from the Tuesday Club, the Arsenal podcast. None of us are Arsenal fans, so we hadn't listened to it, but it was very funny. So if you've got any more Tuesday Club stuff, do send it across because we'll happily do it. Thank you very much. Michael, as we haven't got time for quiz, would you like to choose the outro song?
Oh, I'd love to. And I think it's only fair in tribute to me besting Chris Skoll in the courtroom of Roberto Baggio that we humiliate him even more with Deep Blue Something and Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Beautiful. And can I just... for once, get to say, Robbie Slater, see you later.
You'll say, we've got nothing in common, no common ground to start from, and we're falling apart. You'll say, the world has come between us, lines have come.